Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thanks very much for joining us. I just finished talking with Ian Bogost about his great new book, Alien Phenomenology, or What It's Like to Be a Thing. This was published in 2012 with the University of Minnesota Press. The book introduces and engages the problems of a field that's come to be known as object-oriented ontology. This is, roughly speaking, a group of people who are writing about, thinking about, and producing really, really what I take to be a very interesting work that takes on the problem of what it is to think about, live with, understand, and write about things, objects, units, as Bogost calls them, out of a necessary relationship with human beings. And so if we look at the fact that we tend to take for granted that knowledge of things in the universe is only important and is only relevant and describable in terms of the relationship with human beings, if we try to challenge that basic fundamental premise, how does that open up new ways of understanding objects, things, units in the world, living with them, and practicing the humanities, philosophy, history, social sciences, etc., etc.? What the book does is introduce these ideas and propose a really, really innovative and interesting way through in a language and using a narrative that's extraordinarily pleasurable to read. It's very, very writerly, and it's accessible and interesting, and you learn something from it, regardless of whether you come to it with any background in or pre-existing knowledge of philosophy, object-oriented ontologies, anything like that. So it's really a pleasure to read. There are all kinds of examples in this book that really embody and demonstrate the kind of knowledge through juxtaposition and exploration of universes that Bogost talks about. So he talks about music, he talks about video games, Ace of Cakes, television shows, computers. There are all kinds of really fascinating case studies in here. For me, personally, this is a way of thinking with and thinking through things and objects as part of our understanding that I think could really supplement and change, transform the way we as scholars of science studies, STS, history of science, philosophy of science, sociology of science, do and assume materiality and material culture in our work. I think there's a real opportunity here for adding a very new perspective into the way we understand and think about things in our histories and our stories and our narratives. And this is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons I was really excited to have Ian on the channel. And I'm really thrilled to share this with you. And so I really enjoyed the conversation and the book. I hope that you do too. I hope you have a chance to read the book. And in particular, I'm really excited to bring this to an STS audience. So enjoy. I hope it gives you as much food for thought as it's given me, and thanks for listening. We're here today to talk with Ian Bogost about his new book, Alien Phenomenology, or What It's Like to Be a Thing. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Ian, and thanks so much for making time to talk with me today about a book that I'm actually really, really excited about.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So, Ian, can you start us off by saying just a little bit about yourself and your background? Your work combines the practice and language of video game design with those of philosophy and comp lit. So how did you come to this particular combination of fields?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I've come to anything yet, but I've certainly collected a number of different fields, which I'm, you know, holding hostage in my basement or something. When I was first in school, in undergrad, I knew that I was interested in either computer science or in philosophy. And that was a choice at the time, really. You know, it was, you could do one or the other. And I had been engaged with computing for years and years as a kid, and I kind of wanted to explore what the computer could do, and I was already doing that, but I was also always really enamored of literature and arts and philosophy and so forth. So it was kind of an identity crisis. But what I ended up doing was working professionally all the way through school, almost all the way through school. In the technology industry, and then I figured, well, I'll never get a job as a philosopher, So I'll do this philosophy, and I ended up doing, you know, Compilit too, because it's a thing that, you know, I would like to pursue. It's dear to my heart and all that. And I guess the irony is that I did get a job as a philosopher, sort of, at the end of the day anyway. But to me, the whole thing was always this negotiation between doing computing, doing work with computing, being a computationalist, being an engineer, and being a humanist, and in particular, someone interested in a lot of very abstract questions and in theory, as much as also in specific examples of human culture, you know, most notably poetry and games and photography and these other areas that I talk about in this book and in others. So I guess what I'm saying is that my whole career has been an attempt to try to find connections between computing and the arts. And, you know, I think I've had some success doing that. I've also been really fortunate to have been working at exactly the right moment in time to get some traction with it. But I'm also not confident that I feel like I belong anywhere, which is maybe why I hedge, you know, to answer your question more directly. In the sense that, you know, when one has enough fields, one has no field and kind of doesn't go anywhere. And I'm certainly at risk of being that, you know, that sort of person who's kind of neither fish nor fowl, nor monkey, nor hot wing, you know, whatever.
Well, but I think one of the things that the book does really well is really bring together what you've mentioned as these very, in one way, very different kinds of training, but also I think the book is evidence of the fact that very, very complementary kinds of training. And in some ways, it's better, I think, you know, from the perspective of just one reader, which is all I can offer, for having the kind of freedom that it can speak to a wide range of different kinds of people doing very different kinds of things in different kinds of fields.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one way to kind of riff off what you're saying is that I sort of don't care to make amends or to impress anyone in particular. You know, I mean, I hang out with some philosophers, and you know, this book gets shelved in philosophy, and I like it when that happens, and I feel sometimes like a philosopher, but I also don't, and you know, I have a computer science appointment as part of my job at Georgia Tech, and I hang out with those folks, and I like that too. But I also kind of don't belong there, and so, you know. But it's fine. Like, I'm doing the thing I'm doing, and I've been, you know, fortunate to find a little kind of bubble in which to do that. And I guess one of the things that's happening maybe is that there's interest in that. There's interest in these alternatives, and you know, we've kind of reached the end of disciplinarity. And the whole idea of kind of everyone creating their own little world, their own little universe in which their work makes sense and others can come visit them, like it's a zoo, you know, and they're kind of looking at the exotic, strange creatures that are doing this bizarre work that doesn't make any sense. But then it does, actually, as long as you kind of find an angle to look at it from. I'm quite at one with that. I don't feel oppressed or anxious about this problem of belonging. But at the same time, I'm very aware of it. You know, it's very much on my mind. And I don't have, you know, I teach at Georgia Tech, where we don't have a philosophy department or an English department or even a computer science department. I mean, we sort of do, but everything is all very askew here. And I kind of like that, you know, the idea that there isn't really place anymore that corresponds with, these longstanding traditions in disciplines, and instead we can do whatever we want. We can still do historical work. I mean, I'm not saying we need to throw everything away, but that we can find our way in a new fashion. And you know, projects like this are they're one example of kind of what happens when you let go. Maybe you let go of those anxieties about where something belongs or who it's for, and just kind of let it happen.
Now, one, if not a field, then a pretty coherent area of study that the book speaks to specifically is a larger literature that's often called object-oriented ontology, and you mentioned this in the book. So let's start off by getting actually, or let's start off in our travel actually into the body of the book by starting here and talking about this. So what brought you from this constellation of different kinds of questions and fields that you've been exploring specifically to the set of problems and issues of object-oriented ontology that really form in some ways a heart of the work that the book here does?
Yeah, and strangely enough, there's a very, very particular answer to this question. Back when I was working on my first book, which is called Unit Operations, and which gets some play in alien phenomenology, there was a new book by a then unknown American philosopher working in Cairo named Graham Harman, and this book was called Tool Being, and it was turned out to be his first book on this kind of unique and controversial reading of Heidegger's tool analysis, in which the properties that Heidegger attributes to Dasein, Harman argues, apply to any entity. And I had been incredibly intrigued by this project and this idea of an object-oriented philosophy, largely by happenstance, the happenstance being that I was writing about connections between philosophy and computing. The object-oriented term is a term found in computing. It's a term that Latour and Harman kind of appropriated for different purposes. And so I happened upon this work, and I was eager to see it published, and it was late, and I was kind of anxious to see if there was something here I could cite. And then finally came out, and I was really enthralled by the argument, and cited the book, Harman's book, in mine. And then a few years passed, and kind of by random happenstance, Graham got in touch with me, just kind of ego surfing, I think. Like, you can go to Amazon these days and look up your book or your name, and in addition to getting book results, you get citation results, you get, look inside kind of results. And so he found this mention of his book, and he got in touch with me, and we started corresponding just about whatever. I mean, nothing in particular, philosophy and games and random stuff. And, he and I had a few other points of commonality, and he had worked as a sports writer in graduate school, and just an additional connection between sports studies and game studies, and a lot of those kinds of topics. So there was that connection. And then later I began working on a project with Nick Montfort that we called Platform Studies, which is it's an approach, really, but it's also the name of a book series grounded in that approach that he and I edited at the MIT Press. And Platform Studies is about the relationship between the hardware and software design of computer systems and the kind of creative applications to which they can be put. Nick and I had this perspective on digital media or new media studies, whatever you want to call it, that there wasn't enough detailed investigation into the technical behavior of computer systems, especially in writing drawn from a humanistic or social scientific perspective. And we wanted to initiate an invitation for more of that. We wrote a book, first book in the series, on the Atari video computer system called Racing the Beam. And I realized after writing that book, which is all about the technical design of the Atari and how it influenced game design. And it's a subject that appears in alien phenomenology a couple times as well. After writing that book, I realized that I was actually interested in more than just the sort of secret life of computers. I was kind of interested in the secret life of anything. And so I eventually had the opportunity to connect those two worlds at a conference in 2008 called the Philosophy of Computer Games, which is a fairly regular affair that happens just about every year now. And they invited me to do a keynote, and I chose to do the phenomenology of video games. And I talked about sort of the preliminary thoughts with a specific interest in games, but the preliminary thoughts that kind of led to the expansion of theme that became the Alien Phenomenology book. So That was sort of the origin story of how I connected my existing interests with new ones, and I think there are other factors here. One of them being that the rise of speculative realism and object-oriented ontology in philosophy were largely happening online. And I wouldn't say it's the first time that this has happened by any means, but within the philosophy community, it was relatively rare for a substantial amount of chatter to be taking place on blogs and Twitter and so forth. And without that, it would have been a little bit harder for me to connect with this community, because I'm shuffling between other communities, and I don't go to the philosophy conferences and so forth. So that's kind of the way that I connected my prior work to this new work. And it was very much a very natural kind of process of discovery that actually, why should I be limiting myself to the apparatus of computing? I mean, those are great, and I'm still interested in that. We're still publishing books and platform studies and all. But there's all sorts of other stuff in the world worthy of the same kind of consideration. And I was interested in doing more of that and inviting more of that and maybe translating some of the object-oriented thinking that was still a pretty deeply grounded in metaphysics and in traditions that you kind of have to be a philosopher to understand, making those more accessible to a broader readership, an academic readership primarily, but maybe to anyone. And I guess the jury will be out on whether or not I've succeeded at writing a philosophy book that almost anyone can read.
Well, so the narrative itself opens in New Mexico, and it opens with New Mexico, a range of different kinds of objects and aliens. This introduction, and this is the first chapter called Alien Phenomenology, it introduces one of the central questions that wind up motivating the rest of the book. Why do we ignore stuff, things, objects in scholarship, poetry, science, business as anything more than a way to continue talking about humans? Is there a way to think and live with stuff in the world that doesn't reduce it to that which concerns people, but understands it and lives with it on its own terms? Now, there are all kinds of analogies that we can talk about between this set of questions and the kinds of questions that actually motivate the kinds of people that work in a field that I kind of grew up in, which is history and history of different local communities and their epistemologies in particular, but we'll save that for the end in case we have time to get to it. What I'd like to open with, though, is understanding that this is one of, at least for me as a reader, I take to be the motivating questions. This brings us to the work of a thinker who actually doesn't often come up in the context of discussions about things and objects for science studies in the same way that other people that you talk about, for example, Bruno Latour, Graham Harman to some extent increasingly does, but that very much motivates one of the central foundational elements of the kinds of questions that you're talking about, and that is Quentin Meyesu. And forgive my pronunciation of everything. Is that
that's right? That's correct.
So you introduce very early in the book Quentin Meyesu and his idea of correlationism, or his engagement with the idea of correlationism, and this motivates much of what comes after. So can you start us off, because many listeners may not be familiar with his work, just kind of briefly explaining what is that idea all about and how does that shape how you think about your work in this book?
Right. There's a lot going on in Meyesu's thinking, but the one of the elements that I've sort of cherry picked from him, and this is maybe a common way to use Meyesu's thinking, is this attitude kind of post Kant in philosophy and in theory that being only exists as a correlate between the mind and the world. I mean, this is what we get from Kant, that we can't know if things really exist, so we only know that they exist for us, and forevermore, any kind of conversation we have about the external world is really a conversation about our minds and our idea of what it means for something to exist. And so there's this kind of trump card that's been played in philosophy and in the fields that it influences, that, you know, that of course the natural sciences and engineering find completely preposterous, you know, namely that any time the real world arises in conversation, the correlationist is obliged to add a kind of codicil. This is one of the arguments Meyesu makes, this codicil at the end. Well, for us, right? You know, and one of his examples in this book called After Finitude, which made Meyesu sort of famous as a philosopher, is that, you know, if you say some historical events occurred a certain number of years before the emergence of humans, then the correlationists must say, oh, well, yes, you know, for the human scientist or for the social theorist, that's the case, because we are, you know, constructing that knowledge. And the way that we understand a historical event or a moment in time is always sieved through the perspective of a particular construction of social knowledge. So, you know, you could see this as a sort of prison, if you'd like, that that we can never get outside of our own minds, and therefore we stop trying, and instead we begin kind of playing this game of cards with ourselves, in which we're comfortable with that game. And we can kind of even one up each other in that game, and sort of I'm more socially constructionist than you are, and this, you know, whether or not it's true or right, is actually less interesting to me than the idea that it's boring. This is no longer an interesting way of thinking about the world, and so while the scientist might say, well, you know, the kind of relativism of the postmodern philosopher is damaging to knowledge and industry. Instead, we can also simply say, actually, it's just not interesting anymore. It's just no longer interesting to constantly return every conversation, every object, everything that we might discuss back to the social construction of a discourse in which it emerges. And so I'm, you know, this is me on top of Measu, but that initial invitation to understand this notion of a correlate, of being as a problem of access, and that we don't have access to being. We only have access to this correlate between our minds and the world without. So that is all that we can discuss. This is a subject that that he introduces in Afrofinitude, and it's become you know, quite influential in speculative realist thinking, even among those who don't adopt the rest of Measu's positions, some of which are quite curious indeed.
Great. So thank you so much. So after talking about Measu and then taking us through some of the other people whose work you're engaged with here, including Harman and his work on Heidegger, Whitehead, Latour, you introduced the idea of flat ontology from the work, I think, of Levi Bryant. And this is a way of thinking about the world that grants all things the same ontological status. I mention that because then you go on from there to introduce your really interesting idea stemming from that of tiny ontology. And this is, again, one of these key concepts that's going to motivate the kinds of analyses that we see later in the book. So would you talk a little bit about what is tiny ontology and how does that motivate the kinds of work that you're doing in this part of the book?
Right. So, you know, the idea of flat ontology, which arises, you know, via Bryant, via Delanda, really, you might summarize as, you know, all being is the same. That being itself has the same properties. That everything that is in the same way. The quip I give it in the book is that all things equally exist, which doesn't mean that they exist equally. So it's not a value judgment, but that when it comes to being, all being is the same. So that's flat ontology, and even Levi Bryant is a bit unsure of whether or not there's like how bumpy flat ontology gets to be, right? Harman has his two-part object, the sensual and the real object, and so even fundamentally in his ontology, there's this kind of bumpiness. And Bryant too is unsure about whether, you know, like ideas or fictions should be extant as much as you know, traffic patterns or jumbo jets or whatever. But I'm actually completely confident and at one with this idea of flat ontology, and sort of emphasize that further, to emphasize that flatness further, that all being is the same. I don't see why we need the two-dimensionality of flatness, right? So if you kind of imagine this, you know, the spatial metaphor that's being used to explain flat ontology, that of the line, then how could we show that it's even denser and simpler than a line on which everything rests at the same level of being? Well, there's the point, and you know, the point is the metaphor that motivates this idea of tiny ontology. That all we need to say about being is sort of one word, is, and that's kind of it. You know, that all, if all being really is the same, then let's not muck about over, drawing out a nice timeline in which we can put porcupines and coffee cups and Cobra Commander and so forth, that we can actually condense all of that stuff into this one incredibly dense black hole-like point, and that's where being lives, and that's the best way to understand being. So it's actually quite a small alteration to the premise of flat ontology. If anything, maybe just like a different perspective or another way of emphasizing and intensifying this commitment to a flat ontology. And I think I'm a bit unique among the object-oriented ontology crew in holding such a kind of perversely simple take on being and such a flat version of being.
Well, you take this forward in this context of this first chapter, and this is I'm going to ask you about one more major concept that you introduce here before we move on to the next chapter, because it is important. And you do that by urging us to think about, or rather perhaps stating that you're going to think about objects and things not by using the terms objects and things, but rather by introducing this idea of the unit. Now, I know this is something that you've written about before, but you describe here a way of thinking about this constellation of objects, things as units that behave and interact through what you call operation. So we can simply state units operate rather than saying maybe a thing exists, and that this unit operation is always fractal. Because this fractal nature of unit operation seems really, really important to understanding what you're doing here in a larger context of, you know, thinking about parts and wholes, thinking about how to make this idea work in the context of what STS scholars, you know, frequently think of as networks. This is actually quite different from that, and I think different in a really interesting and a really productive way that opens up very different kinds of questions for STS scholars and perhaps, you know, speaking personally for historians of science in particular. So all that said, in order for listeners to understand what I'm talking about, can you briefly describe, and I know being brief is kind of unfair to ask of you because you have written about this extensively and thought about this extensively, units operate, and we can think about this in a fractal way. What's going on there?
Right. So I think it's pretty easy to get through this briefly. I mean, unit is a word that I've been using for 10 years now as a kind of alternative to a thing or a subject or a system. And what I like about it is that it's a little more ambiguous and a little less charged. It's not so caught up in different discourses. Object has this subject-object problem, and thing is kind of, you know, all stuck in Heidegger to me. And then in Unit Operations, the book called Unit Operations that I wrote some years ago, I'm also distinguishing between objects in the computational sense. So, you know, in computer science, we have this idea of object-oriented programming, and an object has a particular meaning there. So I like unit mostly for pragmatic reasons. It feels like it allows us to talk about this kind of thing that exists, because remember that to me, all things are the same kind of thing, at least fundamentally. And then it allows us to really take that seriously. So the kind of notion of operation, of behavior, is also connected to the idea of containment. And Levi Bryant has this nice sort of frame, weird muriology. So muriology is the philosophical the subset of metaphysics that is concerned with the relationship of parts and wholes. And when you take this object-oriented position, a strong, flat ontological or tiny ontological position, you become committed to a very weird idea. And that's the idea that things have parts, and things are parts of larger things, but at the same time, those things that are parts of them, or that they are parts of, are no less a thing than they are, right? So, you know, the engine on the jumbo jet is no less than the jumbo jet itself, or the cells in my body, or the organs in my body, exist in the same, at the same level of being as I do, as an individual. And so the idea of a fractal relationship between these things is meant to point out that when we attend to any one individual unit, the scale of being resets. It's always the same. Now, the reason why we might be concerned with organs or cells rather than humans, or societies and nation states instead of organs. Obviously, there's all sorts of other stuff that's going on. But as far as the original attention, the question of, well, why would you be concerned with this thing over that thing, with the cells over the organs, or the organs over the culture in which the beings that that surround them comport themselves, those questions can't be answered ontologically. Those are no longer ontological questions that we have other fields in which we need to engage in order to make those choices. But by taking this strong flat ontological position with respect to them, the playing field gets sort of leveled. What I mean by that is that anything is of potential intrigue and interest, and we no longer can assume that the largest thing, or the thing with the most effects — this is kind of Latour's argument, right? The thing with the most effects is the one that we should pay attention to, or even the thing with the least effects, right? Which is one of the directions that critical theory, as born out of identity politics, tends to operate. That we actually can't make any simple distinction about why we might be concerned with one thing over another. Rather, we have to make either arbitrary choices, or we have to be motivated by specific questions and problems. Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but I will say that this is a somewhat controversial position for reasons you can probably already imagine, namely that it would seem to some to be exclusionary or to be risky or, to be violent even. But I see it as just the opposite, that once we recognize this sort of fractal nature of being, then anything we look at, anything we attend to either as philosophers or just as ordinary people operating in the world, we can do the same kind of work with. We can engage at the same depth and the same level of commitment that we might previously have reserved for, quote unquote, things that really matter. So that idea of a kind of weird mereology in which the behavior or the interactions or the operations of units of being are all fair game. Mm-hmm. That's the invitation that my project makes, and I think it's just a really big invitation. It's one that I'm not even sure I have yet taken the book up on, right? But I do see it as just kind of throwing the doors open and saying, let's just get all this over with. All at once, and anything that we can think of, or even the things that we can't, those are just as potentially interesting as the kind of tried and true subjects of critical inquiry, human society, or the physical environment, or what have you.
And I think, and I'll just throw this out there, and then we can move on to ontography. But I think this is one of the really exciting potential points of interest and that I hope historians take up, actually, because this is an opportunity to really redefine what context means and what culture can mean and can look like. And these are two things that historians tend to fetishize, right? Context, cultural context. Well, you're giving us here a way to, and the work that you're engaging with is giving us a way to, I think, redefine and reimagine what context can look like from the perspective of these things.
Yeah. I mean, if I go back to this sort of origin story, this, I was working on this Atari book. The thing that got me, the kind of the hook that lured me in to this way of thinking about metaphysics more broadly, the Atari is a very weird way of interacting with the television. And I won't go into the details, but it's strange. It's unlike any other computer. And as I was studying it, and then as I got involved in programming the Atari, and I make games for the Atari still for some reason. And so I've really kind of lived this experience with the Atari and the television. And I realized, gosh, there's this whole other world in which the television and this 35-year-old outdated video game system, they're having this conversation with each other. They're kind of interacting. They have this whole little world, this whole universe, this microcosm of amazing stuff is happening and has been happening for decades right under our noses. And we just don't notice. We don't attend to that. So that kind of realization, I think, is just constant for me now. And so I definitely think that this invitation applies to almost anything in which you're looking at things that are interacting with other things, which is just to say everything.
Right. So this actually brings us really nicely to this next part of the book. And this is a part of the book where you introduce and give some really, really fabulous and interesting examples of what you call ontography and what others that you're drawing on have called ontography. So for listeners who have never read the book or heard about this, can you explain what's ontography and what's it doing here in the context of the work that you're trying to do?
Yeah, so you're right to point out that ontography is a term now that several of us use with different meanings, which is a little confusing, but kind of fun. For me, ontography means the recording of being, the kind of cataloging of things that exist. And so for me, part of the project of doing this tiny ontological inquiry is exercising the muscle of seeing how much being there is in the universe, which is something that we tend, it's like a muscle we've let atrophy. And so the ontographic process is one of, it could either be a one of creativity or it could be one of analysis in which we look for or we create artifacts that are kind of like catalogs, like bestiaries of the vastness and the weirdness and the diversity of existence. And you know, metaphors are sometimes dangerous, but they're always useful. And if you kind of think about the notion of why we think about ecological diversity, and you know that we want to have rich ecosystems full of different kinds of life in order that they might thrive better together. Ontography makes the same argument, but without the requirement that the things that we be concerned with be living things or be natural things. And so, you know, this is an opportunity to really stretch our attention to allow ourselves to look at and acknowledge the being of things that we would normally ignore. Mm-hmm. Or that we would normally even find repellent, and so you know one of the things that I look for in some of the examples, many of which are from the arts, are works that are trying to be indiscriminate in their recording of the world, that are more interested in that recording of diversity and kind of embracing the largesse of the strange diverse objects in the universe, rather than excluding them with a kind of obvious shake of the hand. I talk a lot about the photography of Stephen Shore in the book. He's one of my favorite photographers for all sorts of reasons, but one of which is that he makes these enormously detailed view camera images of relatively ordinary scenes in the 60s and 70s, primarily in North America, and everything in the frame is sort of, why would you put it there? Why would you have the cans of oil and the tires and the street signs and what have you? But you know, that's one example of an artistic practice. I mean, it's photographic and ontographic, but it's an artistic practice that draws our attention to elements that we might not want to see, that are man-made, that are commercial, that are ugly, even, and forces us to acknowledge them. And so it's that acknowledgement that I'm looking for in this ontographic method. This is a little bit different than what Graham Harman means by ontography, which is a kind of reflection on his four-part understanding of the split being of sensual and real objects. And the word ontography also has at least a few other historical precedents, seeming to refer to kind of a way of capturing geography and so forth. But to me, the idea is how can we record the fullness of being and kind of just let it overwhelm us.
So you introduce in the context of describing these modes of ontographical cataloging, as you call them in the book, you talk specifically about lists and use the language Latour litanies, which I love, which comes up over and over again. So this is something that I think STS scholars who are familiar with these lists of things and objects in Latour will immediately grasp onto and understand what you mean.
Right.
One of the things that I really love about this chapter is that you're not just exploring exploring ontography, but you're also giving an example and sort of practicing in the chapter an example of an ontography with this juxtaposition of kinds of media and kinds of projects that we may not otherwise think of together. So you've already mentioned Stephen Shore's photography. You talk about ghost stories, Brazilian bossa nova, visual ontographs, exploded view diagrams, a game called In a Pickle, and a game that, or video game that I want to ask you to describe a little bit. This is a game called Scribblenauts, which is just on its own fascinating. So can you use Scribblenauts as an example of what's going on here as an ontography?
Yeah, Scribblenauts is a game that came out a few years ago, and there have been a few different releases of it. But you've got this little character in a world, and he's got puzzles to solve. He's got to, you know, reach a particular point, or, you know, save a kitten from a tree or something. But the way that you play the game is you write in words, and the words are made into objects in the game itself. So you could write ladder, and it would give you a ladder, or ninja, and it would give you ninja, or almost anything you can think of. It's actually quite remarkable. There are tens of thousands of words that the game understands, and, you know, sometimes it translates them into common objects that are shared between multiple words. But it's a remarkable and unusual piece of media on its own. But what you find yourself doing when you play this game, you have a problem, and, you know, there's a million ways of solving it. And so the game becomes one of kind of thinking about what you want to incant, which things you're intrigued by or want to see in the world, and then the combinations of them and all the different permutations of objects working together that you can kind of literally play with, that then take on a life. They can animate themselves in this experience. You know, while the creators were not thinking of it as a kind of metaphysics game, it gives us one example of how we can explore that depth of being by having this kind of big capacity, this huge bucket of different terms that that can be invoked, and then we can sort of visit with them for a while. So, you know, that idea of like the bestiary or the zoo or the safari, I mean, those metaphors I think are very apt for this work in general, and maybe for ontography in particular, that you're sort of respectfully at a distance observing and appreciating some small segment of the world, and you're doing so without an interest in intervening even.
Now, the third chapter actually talks at some length about what it might mean and what it might look like to actually do that, and what the kinds of problems are that are inherent in trying to have this kind of distant, respectful relationship toward and also understanding of things, units in the world. Chapter 3 is called Metaphorism, and it opens with a discussion of Thomas Nagel's 1974 essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, which really raises the issue, how do we get at the experiences of others, and especially perhaps non-humans? Now, this leads you into some really fascinating examples, and I wish we had time to talk about all of them. So I'll just kind of try to raise what I take to be one of the central issues in this chapter, and that is your point that we can deploy metaphor itself as a way, as you put it, to grasp alien objects' perceptions of one another. And you make a point here not only that deploying metaphor is a way to grasp alien objects' perception of one another, so that this can help us get at, additionally, the problem of the ethics of objects. So can you talk a little bit about metaphorism, how this functions as a way to get at potentially alien objects' perceptions of one another, and how this relates to an ethics of objects?
Yeah, there's a lot here. So, you know, Nagel's argument is basically, you know, that if you ask what it's like to be a bat, you can describe sort of the, you know, the science of the matter. You can describe echolocation and how it works, and you can draw diagrams, and you can think through it, and you can even possibly understand it to some extent. But that understanding has nothing to do with what it's actually like to be a bat, what it's like to perceive in the way that a bat does. And this argument seems right to me. Right? There is a difference between describing something and experiencing it. Now, if we extend that to just about anything, you know, then we have to admit that, wow, it's not just bats. It's that we have limited access to the understanding of the experience of anything at all. And that not only do we have limited access, but also other entities are in that same condition. So the wall of the cave is subject to the same relationship with the bat that the bat is with the wall of the cave. And you could ask, like, what is it like to be a cave wall? And you would also have no answers. So in order to overcome this problem of not being able to answer the question, what is it like to be a bat or a cave or a bee or a jumbo jet or anything at all, we have to deploy a metaphor that we have to sort of just try to trace the edges of what we can tell about the operations of these units. And from that knowledge, which can be poetic or scientific or come from almost anywhere, from that evidence, then we build these accounts. And those accounts are metaphorical by their nature. So, you know, I can try to describe what it's like to be a bat in terms of sonar, or about kind of how you can close your eyes and listen to sound bouncing off the walls. It's a little harder when I start talking about non-living entities. You know, what is it like to be my coffee cup? Well, it's hard to know even where to start. And so this exercise of metaphorizing entities in order to get a limited access to the notion of their experience. This practice is one that not only is only accessible through kind of a poetic speech or a metaphorical speech, but that demands it and therefore encourages us to embrace that kind of process, because we can't do it rationally. We can't sort of just, as long as we can't describe things and access the experience of something else, then we might as well go to more imaginative lengths in order to try to accomplish at least part of that goal in characterizing how we might be able to understand a little bit about the experience of something else in terms of something that we do understand. And you know, that process is, if you kind of reflect back to the idea of correlationism, strictly speaking, I'm not saying that that the correlation is wrong, but rather that there are infinite correlations. Right? It's not that I can't get outside my own head exactly. It's that everything is somewhat stuck in its own being, and so has to encounter the things that it encounters and make sense of them according to its own sense of the world. Now, given that I also don't have any sense of what the coffee cup sense of the world might even mean, I end up sort of kind of chaining these metaphors together, you know, and you can imagine a kind of process by which I wish I did this more effectively in the book, but if I don't, you know, how would you sort of run this chain of experiences in which you're leading from one to the other and drawing a kind of picture or painting a kind of scene in which a series of entities are engaging with one another on their own terms. It's a very challenging process and one that I only, I think, scratched the surface of in making a suggestion as to how we might begin to characterize that experience. This is kind of the heart of the book, too. This is the phenomenology part of the book, right? The experience of things as unique and different from the experience of one thing as unique and different from the experience of another. So if I try to turn that into an answer to your question about ethics, this has been easily the most controversial part of the book for reasons I guess I should have anticipated. It seems to me that if we don't understand what it's like to be something else, then it is very difficult, if not impossible, for us to make moral judgments on their behalf. What we can do is we can make moral judgments within the inside of objects. So when we are within the object that we call society or a particular culture or a particular community or a family, etc., then we can feel confident that we understand the kind of moral and ethical structures that we've erected because we're on the inside of that thing. We are in direct contact with it. But when we leave that direct contact, which we do constantly and all the time, all we're really doing is projecting our own favorite ethical position onto other things, and then patting ourselves on the back for being true to the ethical commitment that we decided to adopt. And so, you know, the challenge here is not to say that, well, we can't do anything, we can't ever know what is right to do, so let's do nothing, but rather to acknowledge that when we do draw up ethical systems, and when we make ethical conclusions, let's say about you know, whether or not we should burn fossil fuels or whether we should eat animals or what have you, that we are really not doing so on behalf of those other entities. That we are doing so on behalf of ourselves. And so this is a real challenge to ethics in general, to think that when we exercise ethics, we're always exercising it within one or more deeply human-centered contexts. And if we wanted to issue ethical judgment outside of them, we would have to somehow imagine metaphorically, we would have to characterize what an ethics of, you know, ecology or an ethics of coffee or an ethics of kittens or what have you would look like. And this is work that I don't think that we've done effectively almost anywhere.
Thank you. Now, one of the examples, I don't want you to talk too much about it because I want to give us time to move on to carpentry, but one of the examples that you mention in this part of the book, I just want to name for listeners because it also happens to be one of my favorite books, and this is Ben Marcus's The Age of Wire and String.
Right.
So I've said it. Everyone listening to this, go read Ben Marcus's The Age of Wire and String after you read Alien Phenomenology. It's an amazing, the causality is in the wrong way for me to say it's an attempt to do exactly what you've described, because, you know, clearly the relationship is more complicated than that, but it's a really amazing example of an attempt to work in the same universe that you're talking about in this chapter, in your description of sort of trying to get at what it might mean to explode and rethink on the level of different objects. It's a really amazing book.
Right. Yeah, it's a great book.
So which brings us to, as you put it, I think, in the book, once we're done nodding at Whitehead and Latour, what do we do? So how do we turn this into a kind of practice, and how do we relate this to the kind of practice that is normally acknowledged, done, that dominates scholarly work and the work of the philosopher and also the work of other people practicing in other humanistic fields? Chapter 4 talks about what you call carpentry, and this both takes on and kind of talks about the domination of scholarship by the practice of writing. So you ask a question here, must scholarly productivity take the written form? This is something that anyone working in the academic humanities is going to sympathize with and hopefully will have considered. And it's meaningful to a lot of us working in a lot of different fields. You introduce here the idea of carpentry as the practice of artifacts as a philosophical practice. You talked about carpentry as philosophical lab equipment. So can you talk about that a little bit and maybe give an example or two from your own work? And you describe that here in the book to demonstrate and give an example of, you know, what does it mean to practice carpentry as a philosopher, and how might that help us understand ourselves, our work, the work we work on, the objects we work on in a different way?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the carpentry idea is relatively simple at its base. It's the, you know, the notion that if you take a practice like philosophy, then it could be expressed in myriad material forms. One of those is writing. I'm a fan of writing. We don't need to give up writing. But what else could we do? What else could we make? And mostly, why would we only make one thing? So there's a kind of performance of the flat ontological position here, that if we hold writing to be the top level philosophical object of output, the top level object of philosophical output, then what are we missing? And we don't know what we're missing, actually, because we're too obsessed with writing ideas down to look up and see. Now, you know, as far as examples go, I think when I wrote the book, you know, I took some examples from my own practice and from the work of some colleagues of mine. One of the things that I had made and discussed in the book is a kind of attempt to actually display, so to make visible this weird relationship between the Atari and the television that I was mentioning earlier. I also tried to take that idea of the Latour litany and build a little machine called the Latour Litanizer that produces Latour-style lists of things, pulling them at random from Wikipedia's database of entries, and you end up with these kind of luxurious lists that have things that you didn't human design. You know, Latour's lists are very clearly designed, and when you take away that human design element, something else kind of happens. You see juxtapositions you wouldn't see before. So that's an example of a kind of carpentered ontography, right? But then there are other examples, especially since the publication of the book. This work has influenced kind of, I don't know if I'll call them ordinary folks, but folks who wouldn't self-identify as philosophers. I have a number of friends, some of whom work in TV writing and in computing, who are really interested in carpentry as a way of understanding the world differently than they would be able to under ordinary circumstances. One example that I just saw this week, a colleague of mine made a Twitter bot, you know, like a little robotic automated Twitter account that was kind of intervening in the operation of a popular hashtag and trying to kind of find the edges of what was possible in the community of individuals playing, you know, making this sort of one line joke on Twitter. And you know, it's a question that actually occurred to the creator is, okay, well, you know, kind of how does this community work, or how could I investigate the way that they're thinking about making jokes about movies or whatever it was. I can make a little machine that does that work for me. Or another one of my colleagues has made a similar kind of machine that makes presentations, makes like slideshow, you know, PowerPoint style slideshow presentations, pulls the images down and kind of assembles them into this machine made talk, and then you have to sort of decide what to do with that material. You know, like if you allow the talk to run you rather than you running the talk, kind of what does it look like? You know, some of these examples, many of the examples are computational because I work with computing, and a lot of the folks I hang out with work with computing. But by no means do they have to be. And one of the invitations for carpentry is that we don't even know all of the materials out of which we could make philosophical inquiry. Let's go ahead and figure that out.
That's fabulous. I would actually love to see that PowerPoint slide generator. I would love to go to that conference, actually.
Right. Seems yeah, to be a conference of talks by computers. Right.
That's fabulous. So there are other examples in that chapter that are really great, and I'll just mention for listeners just to name it and to shine a light on it. You talk about this Tableau machine as a this kind of kind of carpentry that transforms, as you put it, ordinary family residences into cyborg homes. And it's a really fascinating example there that I'll just highlight for listeners to go check that out in chapter 4. So this brings us to chapter 5. This is the final chapter of the book, and it's a chapter called Wonder. The chapter opens by considering the TV show The Wire and contrasts it with the kind of work done by another exploration of structures of Baltimore, which is Ace of Cakes. Can you talk a little bit about that? What does this contrast do for the kind of work that you're doing in this chapter? And how does this help us understand something about the kind of practices or the kind of carpentry that you're urging us to think through?
Yeah, and you know, in some ways, this is just a restatement of you know where I started the book, you know, which is that we're obsessed with human agency and human behavior and human societies, and so we miss all this other stuff while we're not looking at it. You know, so The Wire, this television show that many people consider to be you know the best television show ever made, and it's so complex and it's got all sorts of things you know intermingling, but really at its heart, all of those things end up being human behavior and individual human behavior as it relates to social structures. So even within The Wire, you know, the kind of the specifics of specific drugs or of mass transit or of shipyards, right? Those things appear in the show, but only as these kind of props for the human actors that carry out the drama. Whereas a show like Ace of Cakes, which I did pick because you know it takes place in Baltimore, I guess it's no longer on the air. You know, the thing that's being created are cakes, and so this kind of obsession in exactly the opposite direction from a bakery, you know, set in the same neighborhoods that are depicted in The Wire, that look at the world in just the reverse way, right? In terms of how can we construct this object called a cake that also represents some other object, you know, like a cake that looks like a boat, or you know, a cake that that's also a golf course, or all the kind of crazy cakes they make on these shows. And the fact that we're so tempted to hold the Wire as an example of media kind of at a higher level than Ace of Cakes, right? This seems uncontroversial. And anyone would say, well, The Wire is a kind of better show, a more sophisticated show, a more serious show than Ace of Cakes. But what if that's wrong? You know, what if all that it is it's a more human-centered show? And in fact, we're missing all of the goodies, so to speak, that we get from paying deep and intimate and systemic attention to something like Cakes, in the same way that The Wire pays deep and intimate attention to the interrelated social systems of Baltimore.
So in the course of this chapter, you also talk about Alton Brown's Good Eats. You could talk about Wonder. This is actually the focus of the chapter. You talk about teaching about Atari. You talk about the native logics of objects. But finally, when you get to the end of this chapter, and this is the last question I want to ask you before we wrap up, you end with Bukowski. Can you talk about why Bukowski? And you know, it's a really significant, this is the last thing that the reader's going to see. Can you talk about the significance of Bukowski?
Yeah, there's this, no one's asked me about this before. There's a secret. It's not that, it's an obvious secret. I mean, this poem is the first few lines of a poem called, a Bukowski poem called 16-bit Intel 8088 chip. And it's in a collection called You Get So Alone at Times That It Just Makes Sense. And, you know, most of the poem, actually, I'm sorry, I said it was the start. It's the very end of the poem, most of which is a very humorous reflection on trying to make one computer work with another. And, you know, you have to format your disk in this way, and then you can't read the Apple disk on the Tandy and so forth. And so it goes through this kind of litany of the wackinesses of using personal computers in the 1980s, and then ends, you know, sort of with this sort of meanwhile, which is a theme of my book, ends with this, you know, this kind of universal contrast, right? You know, the wind still blows over Savannah, and in the spring, the turkey buzzard struts and flounces before its hens. And I just love the fact that that encoded in that little excerpt that I chose is all of the stuff that's missing too, which is, you know, all of my interest in computing and like kind of my attempt to connect that work with philosophy and all the stuff that was always happening all at once, and that's there, that's always there. That we don't see, so it's a little bit of a trick epigraph, if you will. But I also just thought it was even absent that small secret about the poem, that it's really a very different kind of poem than it seems to be. I thought it had the right tone, you know, the right tone to end the book on. That yet there's more has a kind of artistic flourish and merit to it. And that we don't even need to say anything else about it. We know it's there, and we can sort of just nod and shut up.
In fact, you're saying that can make us think of the whole book. I mean, it, for me, is an invitation to look back at the whole book that you've written as a philosophy of meanwhile.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a theme that comes up again and again. And, you know, I guess one of the things I like about this book, one of the things I'm proud of, is that stuff that seems like it's just a kind of offhanded remark turns out to be very important. You know, so this kind of meanwhile business turns out to be really important. You know, it's a fundamental principle of the philosophy I'm laying out. But when you read it the first time, it just sounds like a kind of quip.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to talk with me, Ian. There's so much more that we could talk about. Parts and holes, meanwhile, they might be giants, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But given that, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, of the many, many things that are so great about the book that we didn't talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, especially for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I guess I'd like to mention is that despite this whole carpentry thing, and that, you know, we should do things other than writing, or we should at least think about doing things other than writing, this is a book that I'm reasonably proud of how it turned out as writing. And it was a book that when I was writing it, and then when I was editing it, I felt like a writer at times, rather than like a scholar or like a philosopher. And so, you know, the follow-up that, I mean, there's a number of follow-ups that, that I'm considering, but the direct follow-up to this book, I don't think is going to be philosophy at all. I think it'll just be fiction. And I would really like to capture the feeling that I had writing certain excerpts in this book. The first few pages are, I think, really hold up as writing, you know, outside of any particular context. And some parts of the end of the book too. So, you know, this idea of aesthetics being kind of a first philosophy is something that comes up often in discussions of object-oriented thinking. And I guess I just wanted to highlight that, you know, for me as a writer, it's something I think about a lot now. I think about the craft of writing, and I want to be a better writer, and I want to think of myself as a writer first when I'm writing, not as a scholar who happens to be writing, or a philosopher whose only choice is to write. That's a deliberate choice now, and that when I make that choice deliberately, I have to take seriously the craft practice of writing.
Well, I'll say, just to confirm that really comes out in the book. And in fact, there's a whole bunch of things I didn't ask you about that, as I was making notes for our conversation, I kept a list of some of my favorite quotes. And one of them involved a goldfish sphincter. There are lots of those. So this is just to confirm, I'm really, really glad to hear that you're working or thinking of a follow-up on fiction, because it's yeah. really one of the strengths of the book.
So thanks.
Given that, my last question for you is precisely that. What's next for you? What project or projects are you working on that are inspiring you? And related to what you just said, are you working on already a fiction follow-up to this, and what might that look like?
I'm writing a book this year that's not really related. I mean, it is related, but it's not directly related. It's a book on constraint and creativity. That'll be out, I don't know, 2014, 2015 or something. So it is related in the sense that I'm thinking about this kind of strong attention to things and letting them inspire and affect the way that we act and behave and think about the world. But it's also much more related to my work in media studies than my work in philosophy. As far as the follow-up, the kind of true spiritual successor to Alien Phenomenology, I've done some writing. And it's, I don't know, it's really hard. You know, it's really tough writing, because it's, what I'm trying to do is to kind of take this invitation that I made in Alien Phenomenology and do this, you know, metaphoristic, experimental exploration of what it's like to be something else and to try that on a number of different things. And so far what I've been doing is kind of keeping notebooks of objects I find when I travel to different places that catch my eye, some of which are, you know, completely mundane, and others which connect more directly to the places I find myself. So I hope that someday that will turn into actual work that I can share with the world. For now, I feel like I don't know. I don't know if it will or if it won't. But I'm trying to let it flourish insofar as it's under my control to work on that project. I definitely think I'm not going to write another philosophy book. I mean, there was some question. I mean, I may write another philosophy book someday, but I'm not going to do that immediately. There was some, you know, question of whether I do like alien ethics and, you know, kind of take up this question of ethics that we were discussing earlier and give that the full treatment. For a while, I thought, well, that sounds interesting. Maybe I'll do that. But now I'm pretty confident that I have no plans to do that, and instead I'm gonna try to write this ontography of things from a metaphorical perspective. And we'll see. If it worked, it would work as philosophy and as literature. And I'm not sure if I have it in me. I don't know if I have the skill to do it. But I'm gonna give it a go.
Oh, you have it in you, and I will look forward to reading that. So, Ian, thank you so much. Best of luck on the new projects. Congratulations on this project, and it was really a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.